From the Lone Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. The coronavirus, which originated in Wuhan, China, has made its way to California. The state's two confirmed cases are both right in our area, one each in L.A. and Orange counties. We'll hear what's being planned to keep it under control. Plus, how remembering Kobe Bryant's life in its totality can be problematic. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Now, it would not be wrong for you to feel a little tired, like your head is spinning a bit, because there has been a lot of news these past few days. Just today, a 7.7 magnitude earthquake struck near Jamaica, and the White House has unveiled a Middle East peace plan with no apparent Palestinian involvement. But it is nice to be back on the air after a week of preemptions for the Senate impeachment trial. The president's lawyers wrapped up their opening arguments today. We're going to catch you up on all of this and the aforementioned news on All Things Considered later this afternoon. But we are going to start our show today with what's happening right here in Los Angeles. Five cases of Wuhan coronavirus have been confirmed in the U.S. Two are in California, one in L.A. County, the other case in Orange County. More than 4,500 cases have been confirmed in mainland China. Health agencies here and throughout the U.S. are mobilizing. And for more on what's happening right here at home, we have KPCC's Robert Garova. Robert, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, just to catch us up, what's the status of the patients here in California who have been diagnosed with the virus?
The latest we've heard is that both are doing well. The LA County individual presented at LAX, the Orange County person, he's known to be a man in his 50s. He sought medical care once he was in the OC. We learned yesterday that he's at Hoag Hospital, Irvine. The hospital's treating him in isolation. They're getting help from the CDC and local health agencies, and everybody's sort of working together.
And Robert, has there been any sense of whether there's been any person-to-person transmission of the disease in the U.S.?
So far, the CDC says the disease is not spreading in the U.S., so that means there's no person-to-person transmission. It's just those five cases who had direct contact with Wuhan. They have said in the past, though, that it's likely that we will see some human transmission in the U.S. at some point. We just haven't seen that yet.
Now, what's the latest from our local health department on how it's responding to this? I mean, in terms of messaging, education, and how they're monitoring for new cases?
The LA County Department of Public Health says, you know, that they do not want people to panic. They want people to go about
it's
their...
tough, right, though, because we hear it all the time. Yeah,
yeah, it's true. But, you know, I mean, overall, you know, there's still just those five cases, and that hasn't bumped up for the past at least couple days now, although my mind's getting kind of foggy. So they're not super worried about it yet in LA County. Yeah, that's where the LA County health officials are at.
All right, now I understand that a plane is bound for Ontario Airport with several people on it who have been in Wuhan, China. What's the story with that flight, and how are officials preparing for when it finally lands?
So that flight is supposed to have U.S. government workers and U.S. citizens on board. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar, he said at a press conference just this morning that passengers would be screened and evaluated constantly, is what he said. He said there'd be doctors on board the plane with them. This particular airport, Ontario International, is actually a designated repatriation center for the West Coast. So, you know, from them, they say that they have a lot of training for situations like this, and they're ready to go.
How is the Centers for Disease Control handling these airport screenings, and will they expand that?
They did say they're going to expand it. This morning, they said they're going to expand out to 20 airports. I've been trying to find out if we're going to get any more airports in California, because right now we just have LAX and the airport in San Francisco. We don't know which other airports yet, but it's going to be a total of 20, so 15 additional on top of the five that they already had. So, yeah, that's the basics there.
Now, I also heard that the San Marino School District, that's right near us here in Pasadena, they sent out a notice this week about taking precautions. Do we know what those notices said and if other schools are maybe trying to follow suit?
So I've reached out to LAUSD. I haven't heard anything definitive from them yet. I read the notice that was sent from the San Marino School District. It's pretty straightforward. You know, it basically told parents, you know, if your kids are sick, keep them home. Mm-hmm. You know, they echoed the advice that we're getting from the CDC, you know, and local health officials, wash your hands, stay away from sick people, that sort of thing. You know, they said that they have people at the school, you know, thinking about it. So there's that. I haven't been able to get much more from them on that. You know, it was kind of interesting though, because I did speak with someone from what's called the Irvine Chinese School in Irvine, mm-hmm. and they do language classes, and they're a nonprofit cultural center. They said that they did cancel one of their Lunar New Year celebrations over the weekend. They canceled the Sunday part of it. You know, they said a lot of parents are worried, and that's why they canceled it. And now they're sort of rethinking that because they don't want to cause, you know, too much panic within the area and the Chinese community there.
Sure. Now, the spread of the virus obviously has a lot of people on edge. What should people do at home to stay healthy and feel good about their situation?
Every time I read this, it feels kind of boring because it seems basic. But you know, all the health officials, they're still saying the basics: hand hygiene, don't go near sick people, stay home if you're sick. You know, I will add though that the CDC is now saying no non-essential travel to China, so they've expanded it. You know, to the whole country.
One of the things, Robert, I've heard about N95 masks, they're like the best things for people to use if they're traveling, but it seems like Amazon might have run out of them. Where can people find these locally?
I know in the past, you know, I think the station has got them at Home Depot. I haven't personally gone to Home Depot. I should probably try that and see how sold out or not they are. From things I've read, you know, whether it's surgical masks or N95 masks, there's no real definitive answer from experts on that, especially with the surgical mask, because, you know, they don't fit too tightly mm-hmm. on your face, and nasty particles from sick people could, you know, get around the side. So, in fact, Azar, Health and Human Services Secretary, said today, just this morning, that they're, you know, not recommending people wear those surgical masks, at least right now. There's no reason to.
Well, for what it's worth, I had to be in a hospital last night, and everyone in the waiting room was
the hospitals have said that they're giving them out. So that's true.
Everyone was wearing a mask in the emergency room waiting room. All right, KPCC's Robert Garoba. Thanks a lot, Robert.
Thanks.
On Monday, as we were caught up in the impeachment trial and other breaking stories, the Trump administration scored a victory on immigration. The U.S. Supreme Court voted 5-4 to allow the government to move forward with its plan to revise who can use public benefits. The opponents of this effort say the decision could mean the government will deny green cards or visas to legal immigrants if they're ever used or are likely to use things like Medicare or food stamps. To hear a breakdown of what this means is Susanna Luthi. She's been following the story for Politico. Susanna, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you so much.
Now, this issue has been called the public charge rule, and the administration started to work on revising it last fall. Can you remind us what the White House wants to do here?
Yeah, so basically, the White House went back to a term, and this term public charge has been in our immigration laws on the books since the 1880s. And it's made appearances in various iterations of our immigration laws, basically defining and basing someone's eligibility to even enter the country or stay in the country based on whether they're deemed as a dependent on the government. And what the Trump administration did is they took another stab at guidance. It hadn't been kind of looked at by the executive branch since 1999. So that's the Bill Clinton era. When they looked at the public charge and they said, okay, well, if someone is explicitly relying on the government to live, you know, that couldn't qualify as a public charge. But they explicitly left out things like food stamps, Medicaid, subsidized housing, a lot of benefits that poor people often need and use. And what the Trump administration did is they expanded that definition to include food stamps and Medicaid. And then also they can also look at someone's health status, someone's education level, someone's age, mm-hmm. whether someone has a chronic medical condition, and potentially deny them entry or a green card to stay in the United States.
What's the reason why they wanted to change it?
I mean, this is part of the Trump administration has taken a pretty hard line on immigration, as we've seen kind of ever since President sure. Donald Trump took office. And this was kind of some of our previous reporting has shown that this was a special priority of his senior White House advisor, Stephen Miller, who's a special hardliner on immigration.
Now, this proposal has been challenged in many jurisdictions, including right here in California.
Right.
So what does this Supreme Court ruling do, and what do the justices in the majority say about it?
So, I mean, this was a kind of hard and different order to read. So basically, yes, there are multiple challenges across different jurisdictions, and those resulted in three nationwide injunctions. So that meant even though the Trump administration wanted to start implementing this policy starting in October, that couldn't happen. It was put on hold. And then one by one, those nationwide injunctions have been knocked off. The Ninth Circuit, which, you know, California is in the Ninth Circuit jurisdiction, lifted the hold in December. A Richmond court, the Fourth Circuit, also lifted a hold. And so the last one was from this man, New York judge. And the Second Circuit, which is based in Manhattan, had kind of said, no, the injunction is going to stay in place. This is too big of a change to let you start implementing while, you know, before the legality of this regulation is sorted out. And so what the Supreme Court did is said, you can start implementing it, you know, uh-huh. and meanwhile, you know, yes, it will be on hold or it will continue playing out in the courts. But this is kind of a win because it doesn't for the Trump administration, because we don't know how long these appeals process take. I mean, we all know the long cycles of court cases.
Yeah.
So they can go ahead and start implementing it.
Now, I know, and I've heard immigrant rights groups say they're worried about the effects of this change going forward. Now, what are some of their biggest concerns?
There are a few. I mean, one of the biggest criticisms is that this could really fundamentally change who could come in and expect to be able to live here. You know, it's hard to say. There's not really hard data yet on how this rule will be implemented. I mean, we don't know how this will be implemented, right? So we don't know how hardline immigration officials will be when they're interpreting this. But, I mean, it's estimated that a lot of critics say, you know, you'll have to be a middle class, established in the middle class to be able to move here or stay here. And others say, you know, for the people who are here, you know, maybe they won't sign up for Medicaid. They'll go without really needed health care, which could make their health conditions worse, all in fear of getting denied or getting deported.
Now, I know this issue isn't all the way done and over with. Several lawsuits could continue to challenge the policy. And could the Supreme Court revisit this, Susanna?
Yes, absolutely. Because one thing to remember is the underlying legality of whether the executive branch is able to reinterpret existing immigration laws this far has not been decided in the courts. So as that plays out in the various courts, you know, it could very well go back to the Supreme Court to make the final decision.
Now, what has the federal government said about its next move on this?
Well, the latest I heard from the Department of Homeland Security's agency that is responsible for establishing or for implementing this policy said that they're, you know, they'll have more information soon. They haven't given a specific date. Meanwhile, I can assure you my email has been very busy with docket activity of various briefs and filings going on in all the various courts across the country. So the legal battle is sure to continue. We'll see how it plays out in implementation.
Make sure you pick up the phone when we call you again. That's Susanna Luthi, reporter for Politico. Susanna, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It's been more than 48 hours since the death of Kobe Bryant and that of his teenage daughter Gianna and seven other very loved people when the helicopter they were flying crashed into a hill in Calabasas. The Los Angeles County Coroner has finished the grim task of recovering the nine bodies, and federal investigators are still in the process of figuring out what happened. It appears weather may have been a significant factor. While that work continues, many Angelenos are still trying to process Kobe's life and legacy. You see, it's not as easy as saying he was a great athlete who brought LA championships. It's a lot more complicated, as KPCC's immigrant communities reporter Eric Galindo wrote in an op-ed for LAS.com titled, "I Am Straight Up in Tears Right Now, Why Kobe Bryant's Death Hurts So Much." Here's Eric reading his piece.
My first instinct is anger and denial. Legends never die. But I'm straight up in tears right now as I write this, so it must be real. Kobe Bean Bryant died in a helicopter crash with his 13-year-old daughter, Gianna, early Sunday morning in the fog-covered hills of Calabasas. And Los Angeles will never be the same. It's illogical, man. I don't know why I'm crying. But it also makes sense that the man who constantly wowed us with his feats would end up leaving us in disbelief once more. And Gianna, that hurts that much more. She was his legacy, more than any of the trophies and records. I'm shook. As a former employee of the Lakers TV station, I've had the rare privilege of being in the same rooms as Kobe. I saw up close his charisma and his death stare. I've been thrilled when he agreed to give us a few minutes of his time. I've been frustrated when he canceled last minute or was rude about it. But mostly, I've been in absolute awe of him and inspired by him. So much so that I legit thought he was immortal, the same way I think my father and mother are. I guess that's what it is. That's what's destroying my reality. When Nipsey Hussle died, it broke me. But it was also like, yeah, that makes sense. It was like me dying, you know? It's a bit hard to explain that feeling unless you grow up in places like we did. None of us grow up feeling immortal. But Kobe was hope, man. When he shot those four air balls as a teenage wonderkin, me and my brother were still like, give the ball to Kobe. Even as he failed, we still believed he would bring us a dynasty. And he did. Boy, did we need it. Kobe was a complicated person. He was a ruthless competitor and could be a selfish teammate. And the rape allegations will forever mar his career. But for many of us, he represented the possibility that we, even in our flaws, could be excellent.
What a way to christen the Staples Center with another championship banner.
In 2000, after the Lakers won their first title in the Kobe Bryant era, I went outside and laid in the back of my dad's pickup and stared up at the sky.
Live shot in the Laker locker room, Kobe Bryant cradling the trophy.
I couldn't believe it. The streets of Southeast Los Angeles were bursting with the sounds of celebrations. Car horns, fireworks, gunshots, and I swear, the sound of my enormous smile. High school sucked, and we didn't have almost anything. But we had the title. We had Kobe. He did that over and over again. Kobe Bryant gave us something special even when we had nothing else to cheer for in our lives. And through his legendary determination and hard work, gave us a roadmap to getting our own personal victories. A roadmap no doubt his daughter, Gianna Maria Onore, was following in her own right. In a career spanning two decades, all in Los Angeles purple and gold, Kobe Bryant went on to bring his fans five NBA titles, a victory over the hated Celtics in Game 7, 18 All-Star selections, an MVP award, 33,643 points, 20 seasons of hope, even an Oscar trophy. And there has to be more, right? He can't be dead. Nah. Legends never die.
And there you hear that, the death of Kobe Bryant unifying the city in grief. And remembering his playing career and his life has brought people joy. A lot of amazing moments there. However, not all of it was uplifting. Kobe Bryant was charged with rape. Those charges were eventually dropped. But the totality of his story would be incomplete without mentioning it. The question is, how much air should it get? We'll find out when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Kobe Bryant died Sunday morning in a helicopter crash that killed everyone on board, a total of 9 people, including his 13-year-old daughter, Gianna. Since news broke, there's been a worldwide outpouring of grief and emotional recollections of what Kobe the athlete meant to his fans. But while there is a lot to say about what he did on the court, 5 Laker championships, 2 Olympic gold medals, there's also a story to tell off the court, one that includes being a son, a father, an Oscar winner, a product endorser, an advocate for homelessness, youth sports, and the WNBA, all things that we've heard a lot about in the last few days. But another part has not been mentioned as much. In 2003, Kobe Bryant was charged with rape. Now, the case did not go to a criminal trial. The charges were dropped. They said the accuser was unwilling to testify, and it all ended in an out-of-court settlement. But since his death, journalists and fans alike have struggled with the question of how much of Kobe's story should include that part of his life. And considering the tragic nature of his death, when is the time to bring it all up? Here to try and answer those questions are 2 guests. Juliet Williams is a professor of gender studies at UCLA, and Joel Anderson co-hosts the Slate podcast Hang Up and Listen. Juliet, Joel, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right, let's just get right to the question at hand. When the news broke of his death, and I was heading to the radio station here at KPCC to talk about him and his legacy, I was trying to mentally organize how I would talk about the rape charge in the context of Kobe's life while not being tone deaf to sexual assault survivors. You know, I was thinking things like how much is too much, how much is not enough. So 3 days out, how well or poorly would you say that it's been handled in the media that you've seen? Now let's start with you, Juliet.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. And I do want to say, along with millions of people around the world, how heartbroken I am about this news. And my heart goes out to Kobe's wife and daughters and family. The reality that we continue to live in is that as long as rape and sexual assault are a pervasive aspect of everyday life, we need to be talking about it. And that means all the time, including now. I think that we can look at the coverage in the media so far, and you know, there are some legitimate questions about what we're saying and how good a job we are doing in talking about it, but the first step has to be talking.
Joel, what about you?
You know, I think that things have changed a lot. That, you know, oftentimes media in the past like avoided having the conversation, but now we're at a point at least where when it doesn't happen, it's notable, right? Mm-hmm. And like, so there were a few media outlets, including some of the biggest ones in the nation, that, you know, left out the rape case when, you know, when they're putting together their obituaries and remembrances. And, you know, that's tough, because I mean, the thing is that we handle this stuff as poorly as anyone who dies, you know, like when something like this happens. Like, it's really difficult to want to talk about these things. And we don't even do a great job of talking about this stuff when people are alive, right? Yeah. So we don't have a language for it. We don't have a stomach for it. And we don't want to hurt people who are hurting. And like, hell, I'm not a Lakers fan and not even necessarily a Kobe fan, and I'm hurting myself, right? But, yeah. You know, that's sort of the media's obligation. Right? We have to move beyond that in these really difficult times. You have to set a standard, so.
And Kobe's death has had a lot of us asking a question that we might ask if a family member or a friend died, and that's how do we come to terms with the possibility that someone we love may have done something terrible. So, Julia, I'm wondering, what tools do you think the media and society have gotten from the Me Too movement that, that helps us kind of frame a person like Kobe in our minds?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to really be appreciative of how much work the Me Too movement has done over the past few years. It's not hard to imagine that if we were facing these tragic circumstances just 4 or 5 years ago, that we wouldn't be talking about this chapter in Kobe Bryant's life at all. And in sweeping it under the rug, you know, we would just be adding this idea of it's too soon, it's not polite to the long list of excuses we always have given for not talking about, you know, rape and sexual assault, youthful indiscretions, it's just locker room talk, I like beer, too soon, whatever the excuses are, we've got to move beyond them. And I think that we're doing that now. I think the challenge that we're facing is really how to talk about it and what to say and you know, how to be open and honest and complete. And, you know, what I hope is that you know, we're going to get to a place where we say, look, if part of Kobe Bryant's legacy was he was one of the first celebrities that really got all of us having these difficult conversations about rape and sexual assault, well, you know, that's a part of his legacy that we're going to have to accept. And, you know, maybe there's something in that, too.
And Joel, you know, I think about how if this had happened, not in 2003, but in 2020, I remember Kobe was playing games in the middle of all of this. I can't imagine now, with the lens of Me Too, that he would have been in uniform on a basketball court.
Yeah, you got to think that, like, there's no way. Well, you know, that's actually, let me reconsider that, because, I mean, it was the NBA Finals, right? And that's a very high stakes, you know, that's high stakes programming right there, you know, billions of dollars on the line. And I don't know whether or not he would have played or not, but I definitely think that it would have, the conversation around it would have been a lot different. Whereas, you know, back in 2003, there was a lot more, in a sense, like Kobe was doing something heroic, that he was putting aside this, you know, this rape case that was going on in Colorado and dedicating himself to the team. Whereas now it'd be much more, I'm hopeful, optimistic that the conversation would be a lot different. They'd be like, well, man, why are the Lakers allowing him to play?
Go ahead, Julia.
Go ahead, Dr.
Yeah, I don't want to sound a pessimistic note here too, but I do think we've come a long way with Me Too, and a lot of credit is due for that. But I also think we need to be really cautious these days about exaggerating our progress. You know, so as long as we have a president in office that has, you know, multiple allegations of sexual assault against them that, you know, are as Teflon as anything else, we have to realize that, you know, that there are double standards out there, that we are still as a society picking and choosing when we're going to take a hard look at sexual assault and rape and when we're going to turn the other way. So for sure, we've made some progress, but, you know, one of the tragedies of this untimely death is that we didn't figure out how to talk about it when Kobe was alive. And you know, we're still struggling with that now.
Talking to Joel Anderson, co-host of Slate podcast, Hang Up and Listen. Also, Juliet Williams, professor of gender studies at UCLA. You know, when we think about Kobe's apology, I'm wondering, Juliet, what you think it, what you think is unique about it? Because even though the way he worded it was controversial, at the end of it all, he said this, quote, although I truly believe this encounter between us was consensual, I recognize now that she did not and does not view this incident the same way I did. I mean, what do you make of the apology at the time? And how does this make the case that it's unique?
Yeah, you know, rather than sort of sweeping this all under the rug as we all rightly celebrate all that Kobe Bryant did and gave, I would rather, in this moment of reflection, think about the lessons that we could have learned from what happened. And there's really two. One thing that happened during the Kobe Bryant that period of accusations that is continuing to happen today that really shouldn't is this whole attacking the victims. And we're seeing this with the Weinstein trial. We're seeing still that people who take on powerful men have to face the possibility that it's them that's going to be on trial. So that's one lesson we could learn. But the other lesson has to do with that apology. I wish we could look back and say, you know, the fact that after it was over, Kobe Bryant issued this statement where he acknowledged and validated the experience of the victim. I wish we could say that's the new normal, you know, but that apology remains almost singular. And again, in terms of thinking about his legacy, you know, it would be nice if people, instead of just trying to push this under the rug, could really think about, you know, what opportunities there were for all of us to move forward and thinking about our ways of dealing with rape and sexual assault.
Now, Kobe Bryant never discussed the details of the case, but in a New York Times interview in 2014, he talked about how he set goals for himself after Colorado. Those goals were keeping his family together, winning a championship, fixing his image. In a way, what Kobe chose to do afterward was a result of what happened in Colorado, and some would say he changed for the better. Joel, how do we think about that second act in Kobe's life without framing it as a success story, as some have been tempted to do?
Yeah, well, you know, I was listening to ESPN's The Woj Pod, and Adrian Wojnarowski said something about how Kobe didn't really change, that he just kept winning. And I think there's something to that, but I also think that's sort of reductive, right? Like, everyone is hopefully a different and more mature person when they age from 25 to 41. You know, he became a father, he kept his marriage together, he, like, had all these other experiences and seemed to become a more generous person. But unfortunately, another way to think of it is that it was a really successful rebrand on his part, and he was very open about that. There was an interview he gave in 2014 where he said that the name Black Mamba was sort of like coming up with an alter ego, like a coping mechanism from the fallout of the arrest. He said, people are saying that, you know, what am I going to do now? And, you know, all these sponsors have dropped me and I can't do it. And, you know, his name evoked such negative emotions that he started calling himself the Black Mamba to sort of divorce himself from that previous version of himself. And so, you know, often, you know, the way that I think of it is that Kobe really rebranded himself and was very successful at it. That's from the time he came into the league, he was very obsessed with his image, and like, I don't think that changed as he got older, for sure.
Part of the Black Mamba, and I used to be the host of Lakers Line. I covered Kobe the last 8 years of his career, and part of the point of the Black Mamba image was a bit of an intimidation thing. He wanted to project an air to the rest of the players of the NBA that he is deadly on the court like a Black mm-hmm. Mamba would, but also as a way, and you mentioned this, Joel, as a way to kind of respond to what he believed was a world that was against him. So that's where that came from. But it all does stem from that incident in Colorado, what happened in Colorado. It's like a fork in the road for him, and he chose one direction to go in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he got more tattoos. He started cursing more in interviews. Like, he just became a little bit of a looser person, where he was much more, you know, conscious of his image at that point, of projecting a cleaner image. After that, he became a lot less conscious of that, but he was crafting another image for himself that, you know, it seemed like it worked.
Juliet, along the lines of knowing someone, there's a lot to be said about whether you really know a person like Kobe. People felt close to him. He's in their living rooms every day, doing 360 dunks and winning championships. Is there something to be said about accepting that we might not ever really know what changed in his heart and mind after the rape allegations?
Well, for sure. I think we all need to recognize that there's always going to be a difference between someone's public persona and their private persona. And, you know, I think one of the difficult lessons that we're all learning as more and more allegations of rape and sexual assault come to light is that sometimes people that we love, people that we think of as very good people, sometimes people who have done very good things also have done some very bad things. And we live in a world where we like to believe, you know, there's two kinds of people, good and evil. And the problem with that mentality is that once we start thinking of someone as good, we tend to want to forget about the complexity. So, you know, we missed a big opportunity with Kobe Bryant because he was here with us as all this Me Too movement activity was coming to light. And, you know, we all should have done more to keep this conversation open and to push farther for all of us to be talking about it rather than just defaulting back to the past is the past and, yeah, you know, now he's a hero again.
Hey, Julia, Joel, can you guys hold on for a few more minutes? I want to get back to this in a second. Is that cool?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, coming up, we'll get to some of the media fallout in terms of the timing, bringing up the story when everyone is grieving. That's coming up when Take Two continues, so stay with us. All right, a lot of news to get to later in the day here at KPCC. Nick Roman hosts All Things Considered. Nick, what do you got coming up?
Well, at 4 o'clock, when All Things Considered begins, we'll bring you the NTSB's update on Sunday's helicopter crash in Calabasas that killed 9 people, including Kobe Bryant. We'll have that news conference live. KPCC's LEU is going to walk us through the findings. The Orange Coast College Pirates are playing their baseball opener right now in Costa Mesa.
Wow.
In fact, the game got going about 45 minutes ago. Their coach, John Altobelli, died in the helicopter crash along with his wife and young daughter. We'll have more from the ball game. A Harvard chemistry professor is in custody accused of lying about his ties to China. NPR's Ryan Lucas will have the latest. And Uber's letting some drivers in California set their own rates in response to Assembly Bill 5, the one that made it harder to classify people like Uber drivers as contract workers instead of employees. But the move might mean lower pay for drivers. We'll explain it all during All Things Considered at 4, right after Marketplace at 3, and The Frame at 3:30.
All right, that's Nick Roman, All Things Considered. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. We're talking about Kobe Bryant's life in its totality and when it would be an appropriate time to bring up all parts and all facets of his life. And we're doing that with Juliet Williams, gender studies professor at UCLA, and also Joel Anderson. He co-hosts the Slate podcast, Hang Up and Listen. Joel, Juliet, thanks for holding on.
Thanks.
Thanks.
All right. Not long after news of the crash, a Washington Post politics reporter, Felicia Sanmez, tweeted a 3-year-old story from the Daily Beast that dove into the disturbing details of the case. She did not write the article, and she did not add any commentary to the tweet. She got a range of responses. She was called insensitive. She also got death threats. Washington Post put her on administrative leave for violating their social media policy. Joel, what's your take on that move by the Washington Post, and actually even for Felicia for even posting it?
Man, that's really tough. I mean, at a minimum, you can't say the Washington Post handled it well. As you mentioned, I mean, Felicia didn't tweet anything salacious or provocative. Most importantly, she didn't even tweet anything that was untrue. It wasn't even a comment. So, I mean, I guess the thing is that she just tweeted out this story where there was a very in-depth look at the accusations in the case against Kobe. And so for her to have gotten in trouble for that, like just stating what basic facts were in this case, is really disturbing. And like in the midst of a crisis, like, you know, Felicia at that point was getting like death threats, people, you know, piling on her on social media. And she was in such a situation that she had to, from what I understand, had to leave and move into a hotel that night. So in the middle of this safety crisis, the Washington Post decided that public relations were more important than their own reporter, which is really, you know, disturbing. You'd like to think that, you know, newspapers, I mean, you say what the Washington Post motto is, you know, something about something about bringing the darkness or something like that.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And it's just like, well, you would think that like that wouldn't have a problem with her referring to like the actual truth of the matter, the actual facts of the matter. And they did. And so it just kind of makes you wonder where else they might be coming up short in their coverage of sexual assault and rape cases. And like, why would anybody trust them with their story going forward if that's how they respond to somebody just stating the facts of a case?
And Julia, before I get your response, the Washington Post, about a little under half an hour ago, came out with another statement. After conducting an internal review, we have determined that while we consider Felicia's tweets ill-timed, she was not in clear and direct violation of our social media policy. Reporters on social media represent the Washington Post, and our policy states we must be ever mindful of preserving the reputation of the Post for journalist excellence, fairness, and independence. We consistently urge restraint, which is particularly important when there are tragic deaths. We regret having spoken publicly about a personnel matter. Juliet, what's your response?
Oh, sorry, we were just cut off for a few moments. Could you just repeat that?
Oh, sure. The Post put out a statement on Felicia, and they in a nutshell, they consider her tweets ill-timed, and that she was not in violation of their social media policy, but a reminder that their reporters do represent the Washington Post, and they regret having even spoken publicly about a personnel matter.
You know, as much as I respect the Washington Post, I just think they're confused here. I mean, Kobe Bryant's life ended too soon, but the conversations that Felicia Sanmez was trying to get people to have are long overdue. And, you know, now is the time. It's painful, it's uncomfortable, but it is now. We should have been doing this a long time ago, and it's, you know, never too soon to start. So I hope to see soon the Washington Post reflecting on, you know, their own activities, because there's just no way that it's going to do any honor to Kobe Bryant's legacy, let alone to, you know, all the survivors out there, to just try to artificially impose, you know, these kinds of censorship on the conversations that we're having.
Joel, do you think? Oh, go ahead, Joel. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say to kind of build on what Dr. Williams just said there. Like, if the tweet itself is a bad act, I'm somebody that represents a media organization right now, and I tweet all the time, probably too much. But you'd think that if the tweet itself is a bad act, like just tweeting out a story without any commentary, a story that was dedicated to the facts of the case, then like you'd have to think that the Washington Post reporters and staff should probably stop tweeting if they're going to get in trouble for something like that.
You know, wondering in covering this, how can journalists be sensitive to sexual assault survivors who are being bombarded with glowing tributes to someone who was once accused of rape? I was trying to put myself in the shoes of someone who lives in Los Angeles and is watching all this, but is maybe inside, you know, hurting. Juliet, what's the advice there?
I mean, I think it's the advice that we give to journalists all the time. Tell the truth. Tell the story. This is part of the story of Kobe Bryant. And, you know, let people have the opportunity to grapple with it in all its discomfort and all its complexity and all its messiness. We got into this problem in this country, in this world, where we turn a blind eye to rape and sexual assault precisely by always excusing not talking about it. And we should now, and going forward, always be suspicious when people are giving excuses for not talking.
I want to squeeze one more thing in really quick. In Esquire, Charles P. Pierce wrote this about how people might try to judge Kobe's legacy. He said, quote, "How you will come to measure his life has to be judged by how deeply you believe that he corrected his grievous fault through the life he lived afterward." Now, Joel, for anyone wrestling with how they should look back on Kobe's life, does that statement ring true?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a piece of it. And, you know, I've been saying in recent days that if your support and your admiration for Kobe is strong enough, like if you, you know, really loved Kobe and were a big fan of his and everything that he did up until the end of his life, it should really be able to sustain a real analysis and review of his life as he lived it. And I don't believe that people are this weak. I do reject the idea that fans of his can't handle this, because it's not like that is not the only that's not the only conversation we're having about Kobe. It's only a small piece of it. So I think that if you love Kobe, if you're a fan of his, and you want to, you know, talk about his legacy going forward, then you should be able to deal with this and just say, you know what, that was a piece of his life. It doesn't mean that he was wholly a bad person. It just meant that he was a person.
Julia, what about you? You get the last word.
You know, I think that the part of there's so much that's tragic here, and this was such an untimely loss for all of us. This story wasn't finished, but now it's over, and so for any of us to expect it's going to be neat or resolved or satisfying, you know, they're missing the point here, which is the tragedy, and we're just going to have to face it head on.
Juliet Williams is a gender studies professor at UCLA. Joel Anderson co-hosts the Slate podcast, Hang Up and Listen. Julia, Joel, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
All right, we've been hearing a lot over the last few weeks about money to Ukraine. Coming up, we're going to hear how some of that money has been spent. That's next on Take Two. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Over the past 5 years, the U.S. has paid out more than $1 billion in military aid to Ukraine. The ongoing impeachment case in Washington centers on President Trump's handling of some of that money. Meanwhile, the U.S. military support continues. American aid is helping the Ukrainian army buy vehicles and supplies, and U.S. troops are continuing to conduct training with their Ukrainian counterparts. From Western Ukraine, Levi Bridges reports for the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans.
The Combat Training Center in Yavriv, Ukraine, stands near the border with Poland. It's a military base, out in a quiet stretch of forest and marshland, lined with fluffy cattails. For the next 9 months, this is home for more than 150 members of the Wisconsin National Guard. Some have done tours in places like Iraq, but this mission in Ukraine is totally different.
In Iraq, we had weapons 24/7, go to the bathroom, guess what's going with you.
I'm walking with Major Catherine Burbridge. She's unarmed, and it's peaceful here. Some of the soldiers spend their downtime playing with the dogs.
Where's your babies? Where's your babies, Mama?
You're so cute.
About a dozen dogs live on base, mostly strays. This morning, Burbridge is looking for some lost puppies.
Oh, here they come.
A bunch of puppies just came out from the tanks. Yep, puppies coming out from the tanks. Here, it's easy to forget there's a war going on, hundreds of miles to the east. This is where some Ukrainian soldiers come for training, before they go to the front. About a mile away, you sometimes hear gunshots and demolitions as soldiers go through artillery training. But Ukrainian troops also spend a lot of time here in classrooms, learning how to operate an army. The U.S. troops, they're training the Ukrainian instructors.
How to instruct, how to evaluate, how to assess training. That's really what we're doing.
Colonel Michael Hansen is the deputy commanding officer here. The Wisconsin National Guard is the 8th group of U.S. soldiers who have rotated through here since 2015. Colonel Hansen says U.S. military aid here is a collaborative process with Ukrainians.
What we try to do is sit down with them and say, what do you need? What does your army want? And then we're using our expertise to help teach that. Not what America wants, but what they want.
Success for the Ukrainian military means training their soldiers to work with NATO. President Trump has criticized NATO as a waste of money. But Colonel Hansen says this mission is a serious bang for your buck.
We are a nation that only has so much money, so we can only have a certain size military. By being out here and building these partnerships, we've now taken a 1 million-man army and turned it into a 2 million-man army, and we're not even funding the other 1 million people.
In one of the classes, I watch American and Ukrainian soldiers discuss a military operation through an interpreter.
My view
of the entire mission.
Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Walsh stands next to me. He helps oversee these classes.
They're just kind of nerding out on strategy right now.
Yes, they are.
Walsh says strengthening the armed forces of our allies, that's a huge part of what the military does.
I think it's in America's interest to promote democracy. Ukraine is a fledgling democracy, and that our job is to work with their military to help them achieve their political goals.
Walsh says folks here follow the news about impeachment, Rudy Giuliani, all that. But he says it really hasn't changed the mission.
The political disruption that's going on doesn't affect our day-to-day operations, and it doesn't affect our relationship with our multinational partners.
There is a real sense of camaraderie here. At night, the Wisconsin troops play a blues concert for some Polish and Lithuanian soldiers who are leaving. At the show, a Ukrainian soldier calls to me. He says, "We're so grateful to the Americans. We love you." In Yavriv, Ukraine, I'm Levi Bridges.
All right, now for an update on a high-profile book, a high-profile book reading, that was supposed to take place in Pasadena tonight. In case you missed it, Roman's Bookstore on Colorado Boulevard told us that the visit from American Dirt author Janine Cummins was canceled by the publisher, Flatiron Books, following controversy. American Dirt is a story of a Mexican mother who heads north on a harrowing journey to the border with her son after her family is murdered by a cartel. It was hailed as one of 2020's most hotly anticipated novels. But prominent Latinx authors and many others criticized the book for relying on and perpetuating stereotypes and tropes to describe the migrant experience. The controversy surrounding the book has inspired a lot of conversations around who is allowed to tell what stories and whether the publishing industry is, like the Oscars, so white. Later this week, we'll take a deeper look at some of those questions. So please tune in for that on Friday.